saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, including pouring a walkway, setting a post, or even installing stone veneer. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Diet sodas are terrible with all the additives, preservatives in them, and the hidden sugar.
I mean, this tip alone shows you they don't know what they're freaking talking about. Of course it does. If you replace regular soda with diet soda, you're eating less calories. You're consuming fewer calories. That's how you lose weight. If everyone stopped drinking regular pop and switched to diet pop, people would be losing weight.
Yeah. Why did dietitians say things like hidden sugars for diet soda? Like, can they really put zero calories on a can of Coke Zero and then it actually has caloric sugar?
Oh man, here we go. Starting out strong. First of all, I had never seen this guy before today.
So, Greg Doucette?
Nope. Oh, so wow. He's not on my radar. Nope.
Yeah.
So I guess he took a clip from a dietitian who claimed that there are hidden sugars in diet sodas, which we know there are artificial sugars in diet sodas and a variety of different artificial sugars in diet sodas. Mm-hmm. So this shouldn't be demonizing either way. It's interesting to see that he picked up one little clip and where he's going with it.
Mm-hmm. He's pretty famous for saying dietitians don't know what they're freaking talking about. Yeah. But at the same time, there's a lot of, you know, morbidly obese dietitians and doctors, and they do say some kind of crazy stuff sometimes. That's why, and Greg's a kinesiologist, so he is actually professionally trained. But he has made millions from selling a $100 cookbook.
Wow. Yeah.
And ripping off. Well,
and his turkesterone.
And, yeah, supplements.
Well, he's pretty ripped, so he must know what he's talking about, right? That's how it works.
That's how I gauge it.
Yeah. That's how the gym bro.
Pass the visual test, mm-hmm. maybe.
Yeah. Credentials.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
Do either one of you drink diet soda?
Yes, I drink diet soda daily. Usually in the form of energy drink, which is zero calorie, or Diet Coke. I like the aspartame over the other Coke Zero sucralose.
Oh, yeah.
What's worse or better, a diet soda like a Coke Zero or an energy drink?
Ooh.
You know, a Monster.
That's pretty tough.
Because I know you love energy drinks. I love them. But you are not a fan of energy drinks.
So it's not that I'm not a fan. It's now we're getting into the caffeine debate, right? So a diet soda is going to give you between 30 and 50 milligrams of caffeine, whereas an energy drink could be an average of 218 milligrams of caffeine. Depending on the now that they're getting kind of larger size. So now you're getting 2 to 3 times what you maybe would have gotten. So that's more of my concern is how much caffeine is this person getting and what other sources of caffeine are they getting throughout the day? And then what's that accumulate to? And then how's that affecting their sleep and energy levels and everything else? Because we know you can't out-caffeinate poor sleep. So I think that most of the people that I work with are more on the energy drink side because that's kind of how things are now. You see more energy drinks in vending machines and there are advertisements everywhere. I would say that they probably outnumber the number of advertisements you see on soda. Or diet soda, no matter what kind it is. So when I look at soda or energy drink, I don't think sugar necessarily. My brain goes to caffeine.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. When it comes to a limit of caffeine, since you guys are trying to agree with this, think of a number of what the average person, not a fast or a slow caffeine metabolizer, you know, the average person, how much caffeine should their daily limit be?
Well, science says 3 to 6 milligrams per kilogram, or if you want to just round it out, we'll just say about 500 milligrams a day. And if you think about it, that might be 2 energy drinks. You know, coffee, for example, A serving, an 8 ounce cup of coffee could range from 80 to 120 milligrams of caffeine. But who drinks 8 ounces of coffee? I don't.
Yeah, nobody.
Minimum 10 ounces, right?
Yeah.
Probably 20 ounces in the morning. That gets you started. And then maybe you'll do an energy drink later on, maybe after lunch, once you get that kind of post-lunch snooze going. Mm-hmm. But I think that making sure that, you know, one of the rules that I really liked about your 10-3-2-1-0, which I use a lot. If you're sensitive to caffeine, if you are having trouble sleeping, that's one of the first questions I ask is, how much caffeine are you consuming? When's your last caffeine dose? So at least if you're going to consume caffeine, try to consume it earlier in the day as opposed to 4 p.m. right before you hit the gym, before you go home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that makes the most sense. I would probably agree with the 500 milligrams. Personally, no. But from a broad standpoint, yeah, of course. I think 500 milligrams is a good middle ground.
Yeah.
I think if you get into like the 600 or 700 milligrams, depending on your age,
yeah,
even above that, you're fine. I did read a study where it was like, I think it was, you're safe to consume up to like 900 milligrams a day, although that's not very efficient for proper lifestyle.
And also, you know, I like to give the 3 to 6 milligram per kg range, because I could be talking to a 5'1" female or a 6'5" male, and 500 milligrams of caffeine is going to hit both of them very differently.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then the context of, are they eating enough? Like what are the other things that are going on with those people? Mm-hmm. But overall, if people are like, I just need like, what's a number? 500 is probably a good one. Try to stay below that, because once you go above that, once you get to like 9 milligrams per kilogram plus, you start to get the negative side effects of caffeine.
What about for states like pregnancy? So you have estrogen excess, so you're a very slow caffeine metabolizer.
Yep.
And, you know, even just figuring out how much caffeine is in our super automatic espresso maker. Maddie and I have one at home.
Yeah.
And I do what I consider normal beans, which is 4 of 8. Because 4 of 8 is halfway. That's normal.
Yeah.
But she does 6 of 8, which she says is normal beans, because that's the way it came preset from the factory. So she's using 50% more beans each time.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's read things that say something like, you know, up to 2 to 3 cups of coffee are safe per day during pregnancy. So I guess, you know, but how, we don't really know if that equates to 100 milligrams or 300 milligrams.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, she may have had like 3 or 4 cups a day. She still grew a 10-pound plus baby.
Yeah.
So, that is true. But what do you tell people for situations like that?
Yeah. And it's tough because, so first of all, nutrition research is really hard to do for many reasons. We can't exactly ethically pull a bunch of pregnant women together, give them a bunch of caffeine, just see what happens, right? Like, we don't know. We don't know the answer. But for me, so I have 2 kids, 5 and 8. And when I had my first kid, when I was pregnant with my first one, I omitted all caffeine as much as I could. Maybe a diet soda here and there, but I tried to be as by the book as I could. By the second kid, I'm like, it's fine. But generally, what I've heard and what I try to do, for myself is stay within 200 milligrams ish. Right. Like, obviously, like you said, if you brew coffee differently, you don't know how much caffeine you're getting, but you don't want to go too crazy on the caffeine, because now that could be substituting from other beverages. Like, maybe you're drinking coffee instead of a glass of milk that you really did need for to help the baby grow. Mm-hmm. So making sure that you're not substituting a caffeinated beverage for something that you need more.
Mm-hmm. I tend to substitute my high caffeine days when I feel like I would generally need it most, you know, 4 hours of sleep like last week.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm doing some degree of shift work or jet lag, I take a modafinil.
Yeah.
But, and I know a lot of people in the military where you also work are like, there's certainly clinical indications for modafinil for shift work sleep disorder. But what do you think about that and other stimulants? And do you stack that with caffeine? Because I always try to consume 50 mg or less.
Yeah.
Because that way, you kind of get the best of both worlds.
Yeah.
Of caffeine or modafinil?
On my modafinil days, I try to consume very low caffeine, not none, because then I'll just get a withdrawal headache.
Yeah.
But I try to go low, and then that way I can actually get off the modafinil.
Yeah.
And I'm hypersensitive to the coffee or caffeine when I go back a day or two or 3 days later.
I can tell you what I did this morning.
Oh, let's hear it. Let's go. Let me take a sip while we do that.
This morning, I got up at 5:30 in the morning. First thing I did.
Is that early or late for you? Because that's late for me.
Really early.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really early.
Okay.
I got up at 5:30. The first thing I did was I opened my little container and took 50 milligrams of modafinil. And then I brewed coffee. Mm-hmm. Had 2 cups of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Went to the gym. No food.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the way to work, I had a 300 milligram can of an energy drink.
Let's go. Yeah.
Nice.
I mean, I wake up at 4 a.m. every day. So
it's early.
Yeah. Yeah. It's part of the job. And it is tough. Like shift workers, first responders, military, anybody who works night shift or works any kind of weird, unnatural schedule. It takes time. And you can't just rely on modafinil or supplements. Obviously, that is always part of my conversation with them is what's their caffeine cutoff? What are they used to? Try not to do anything brand new when you really need your brain. Like, let's trial it before, and when you're in a safe place before you get to that time. I find that adjusting meal times and even meal what it is makes a big difference. You have to train your body to adapt to that. I didn't naturally wake up at 4 a.m. and feel alive, right? Like most people don't look at 4 a.m. like, oh, let's start my day. I have so much energy. That takes time and repetition. And now I have a rhythm and my body's used to it and I still get adequate sleep somehow most nights. But then when you have those nights when you got 4 hours of sleep, you have to have that backup, and you can do that with appropriate dosing of caffeine and supplementation and then prescription medications to help you with the sleep onset and then wake up in the morning too.
Yeah, I like that. I also like that you took 50 mgs of modafinil.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Because a lot of people don't realize you can dose it lower. You don't have to look at the narcolepsy dosing of 200 to 600 milligrams and then try to stay on that.
Yeah.
That's a good takeaway. A lot of people are concerned about getting good sleep. And, you know, maybe they follow Huberman, our friend Andrew Huberman on Twitter, and they say, oh, just take some pineolone or some growth hormone releasing peptide or some tesamorelin. And, you know, of course, these prescriptions have their clinical indications. Some more than others, but can you just take, you know, some HGH or some growth hormone peptide or, you know, are you better off doing things like modulating food and nutrition for that?
Yeah, I would say you should probably do both. I think, I think a GHRP mainly.
I think it's easier for people to take a pill.
Yeah.
It's always easier for people to take a pill. It's much harder to put even just a little bit of thought behind, like, oh, let me adjust my eating window a little bit more. But the eating window will give you much longer lasting results than taking a pill. So there's a balance for both, right? Like if you have one of those days where you just really, really need to be on, use both. You need it. But if like for me, with my job, I start really early. So taking a pill every day is probably not the best way to adapt to that. I needed to train my body. And by doing that, it meant modifying meal times, modifying what I have at those meals, and timing my caffeine appropriately so I can still go to sleep at a decent hour so I can get my ideal, you know, 7 to 9 hours of sleep. 9, I never touch that. I'm more like 6 to 7, but it makes me feel good. So.
Yeah. I think you should do both, but only after you've optimized your lifestyle first.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it makes sense to start with like a GHRP.
But most people start the other way, right?
Because
it's like I said, it's easier to take a pill, easier just like, oh, let me like put a band-aid on this because it's too hard to think about meal prep or, you know, whatever.
That's my number one frustration with dietitians is
why are we picking on dietitians so much right
you
now?
You spend all this time and, you know, it's a frustration with all the interdisciplinary team because, you know, people very quickly try to have, you know, maybe one appointment with a dietitian and then quick little 5-minute appointments with their doctor. And in that time, what people want is very specific nutrition advice.
Yeah.
And they want to get off pills, off supplements, off medications. But when they come to me, often I do put them on a supplement or a medication, and then they also see a dietitian.
Yeah.
And I would say almost all of them, except for you and Adrian, our other sports dietitian, and a few others, they end up just starting more supplements, and they have more foods taken away. Yeah. Whereas, you know, if a dietitian, and obviously we have a good working relationship over many years, but if you don't really know a dietitian, often they feel like they're treading on thin ice, and they say, would you potentially be open to maybe stopping this supplement or medication and then doing this other food instead? And it's just ridiculous. How do we fix this problem other than just giving patients more time?
Yeah, it is really hard. I tell people all the time, you're not going to get the best out of me if you only see me once. Because that's me getting to know you essentially the first time and me just taking everything in, assessing it. As you're speaking, I'm thinking about what's your stress level, what's your work schedule, what's the family like, what is happening in the environment, what happened from, I go way back to when people were born. Like, were you on a bunch of antibiotics when you were a kid? And this gets into like the gut health conversation when we do that. And then me gauging like in the spectrum of willingness to change, where are you? Are you in pre-contemplation, contemplation, action? Where can I take this patient? And a lot of times they come in like, I want all the things. I'm like, you're not ready, but I don't tell them that. It's listening first and then giving them, we were kind of talking about this before we started going, give them something you can't fail at. Like, start the goal somewhere, because once you start one thing, it adds on. Whether it's, I only work out once a week. Hey, let's go for a walk after lunch twice a week. You know, that's not asking a lot. And then that starts to get the cycle going of, I feel better, I'm going to, you know, sleep better tonight, whatever it might be. I think that a lot of dietitians or practitioners may be afraid to kind of go in and say, do this, do that, or don't do that, or like maybe do this. And it kind of depends on, for me, my conversations with each of my patients are all different. Mm-hmm. I kind of, through getting to know them, I know how direct or indirect I need to be. I can tell this guy, hey, I need you to do this if you want this result. Or if somebody is a little bit more hesitant, they're not in the action stage yet, I have to explain to them a little bit more of the science in a really concise way. That's going to get them to believe me. And then once I know, if I can give them something that's going to make them feel just a little bit better, I got them. Now I got them. Now they're starting to trust me, because something that I said is starting to make them get the feeling that they're going for. But it is like a lot of my answers to questions I get are, well, it depends. Diana, should I be on this keto diet? Diana, should I take the supplement? Diana, whatever it might be. Well, it depends. Let's dive into that a little bit more. Trust me, I get frustrated hearing that too. But everything that I do is customized. I don't give out blank plans that are copy paste to anybody. And that's really, really important. Just like, you know, for you, same thing.
I usually just have everyone do a gut microbiome test, because it makes us like $150, right? Cha-ching. And then I have all of them do either a CellCore protocol.
Yeah.
Because again, cha-ching.
Yeah.
Or a total gut restoration kit.
Oh, absolutely.
And honestly, I don't even look at the microbiome test. And it's just a more efficient way of running a business.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, helping people functional.
Sounds like a functional medicine. Root cause
medicine, baby.
You know? Yeah. It's a great business model, you know, just pump them in and out, kind of like a testosterone clinic or whatnot, you know, but.
To play devil's advocate, in all seriousness, for individuals who are morbidly obese, how much does it really help to tell them move more, eat less? Or eat less, move more, right? You've heard that, right?
Yep.
Because
I think
how much does it help to tell them that? And then how much would it help if they actually did that compared to getting all this like niche?
I think it's very, I think a lot of practitioners, I don't even know if they're aware of it, but they gaslight patients all the time. Like, can you imagine being a patient who has reached that level, come in to see a provider, anybody, whether it's me, you, whoever, and they're told, and this is not the first time they've heard this, you should exercise more and eat less. Can you imagine how frustrating that would be and how defeating that would be to that person? Like, give me something that I can actually do and actionable. And like, you know, if somebody is overweight, if somebody's unfit, if somebody doesn't exercise, they don't need to be told that. They already know. They already know. They know the scale's going to say something that's not good for them. They know that. They need to be convinced and understand what is the metabolism, what's happening with the metabolism. Find out what they really care about. Is it an overweight guy who, you know, is he worried about his testosterone? Focus on that. Is it a female who's entering perimenopause, menopause, and she's worried about her body changing? Focus on that. Don't just, it's such, man, it's, I really hate hearing stories of patients who are gaslit by providers who mean well, but maybe that provider's just really frustrated by everything and they just kind of like let it go. And I'm like, you have no idea what those words are doing to that patient right now and how those words are going to replay in that patient's mind for hours and hours and hours.
When those things happen, I feel like very often what the provider means to say or has a difficult time saying is, you know, a patient says, I'm working out really hard and I'm not seeing progress. Instead of saying, I'm not really an expert in this. And maybe the patient is just doing all cardio and needs to do strength training. Like there's some very simple things, but many doctors are not well versed in this. They'd be better off asking advice to Cameron.
I would agree.
But instead they should say, I don't know, but let me find someone who does, like a personal trainer or a gym buddy, accountability partner to help with consistency. Or, you know, even just asking a friend. That's why Maddie gets a gazillion questions about her protein and fibers. Yeah. Everyone's always trying to, they're like, you know, how they know enough.
How do they look like
they know need to get their protein in.
Yeah.
But they need actionable advice, like Huberman always says. Something that people can actually do. But, you know, people are concerned. They say, well, should I do something about my testosterone of 350 as a guy? Or maybe a female has relatively low testosterone, but they're not sure if it was like taken at the wrong, wrong point in the cycle. And they ask their doctor and the doctor says, oh, it's fine. But that is false reassurance.
It is.
Gaslighting.
Because you're, because again, that goes into labs. Like if a lab range is normal, but the patient's telling you, but I'm not, okay, this is not me. I don't feel like myself. You can't dismiss that patient. You have to listen to, treat the symptoms, not the lab. Treat the symptoms, not the, whatever X result may be. But I really like the idea of, I wish more clinics or any clinic, honestly, like referring out, I wish it physicians or clinics like this would have like, hey, if you want to go, you're starting an exercise regimen. I think that's amazing. I have this deal with X gym. You get 10% off because you're seeing me as a patient. Do that. Like give them something to get them started. Like, okay, now that's an actionable thing. And it's still not like an actual action, but it gives them like, okay, my prescription is I get a discount at this gym and I really enjoy it or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I like that. How difficult and expensive is it to start a training protocol like that? Because, you know, we both go to the gym. We all go to the gym relatively regularly, but whenever I post about this, I get a lot of, you know, I guess, negative comments that say, oh, well, you go to two different gyms. Do you realize how expensive that is and that the average person cannot afford this? And they'll say, well, you know, must be all the TRT and peptides and whatever else. And must definitely must be that because you were definitely not in, you know, essentially just as good of shape before all of this.
People just can't believe you're in good shape. They're not used to seeing a fit doctor.
People don't like it. you know, from someone's perspective who is younger and without kids. I know Maddie's mentioned that she would not listen to the advice of someone who didn't have kids. So I guess you meet the criteria, but I don't know
if she would meet it. I bet I'd get her to listen to me.
But, you know, the concepts are, the physical concepts are still similar, but the mental concepts are different. But I think you can answer the question relatively well. You know, a guy is concerned about testosterone, mm-hmm. and chicken or the egg, is it the guy is hyper-focused about testosterone and just refuses to train hard and mm-hmm. improve his diet when he sees that number being low? Because I've seen a lot of people with very low testosterone who are extremely fit and extremely aesthetic. Yeah. But how much does actual like testosterone or TRT matter versus just dialing in your diet and training versus, you know, just going to a med spa and getting a GLP-1?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think it makes more sense. It's obviously, like you like to say, Kyle, it depends. Depends mm-hmm. on what the...
You can't say depends.
I know. But it does depend, though, on, like, what is the patient? Like, is it a male patient that's extraordinarily overweight? Is it just out of shape? Mm-hmm. Either way, I think the best thing you can possibly do to start, is again, is lifestyle changes. If it is going to the gym, I mean, Planet Fitness is, what, $5 mm-hmm. a month?
Yeah.
It seems pretty cheap. It's pretty reasonable, if you ask me, compared to some places.
Yeah.
You start there, you start them on a decent program. And if you want to get put in the extra effort and you're a provider that knows what they're talking about, you can kind of help guide them in the right direction in terms of training as well as diet. I mean, diet as well. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. You just have them, if they're drinking too much soda, you tell them, hey, maybe just cut out one Coke a day and then go from there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then after all those changes have been made, then you can start talking about lab work. And well, obviously you should be getting lab work the entire time, but testosterone, TRT, yep. HRT, anything mm-hmm. like that. Because I guarantee if they're overweight and they lose a lot of that weight, their testosterone is going to go up mm-hmm. quite substantially.
It's like turbos or nitrous on a car.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
It is possible to, in a lot of cases, not every case, it is possible to recover testosterone with diet and lifestyle. For sure. It takes time. It's not going to be as fast.
Yeah. Well, I think it also depends on like, is the person at zero testosterone?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
If they're at like 300 or 400, I think it's better to start on lifestyle rather than something else.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
With females, it can recover faster. With females, it can. Often underfed, kind of like hypothalamic, amenorrheic spectrum females. With males, especially very obese males, occasionally, if they're younger and they do want fertility in the near future as well, then things like HCG or even enclomiphen are reasonable because they're probably very high in the estrogen excess category. But too many people just seek out a, you know, what I call a cookie cutter telemedicine clinic where they're just going to get enclomiphen and they might not need it. What frustrations do both of you see with people that are just, you know, haphazardly hopping on these peptides and Clomid and this and that because, you know, it's optimizing them.
Yeah. It's frustrating because those clinics are making so much money off of that person and playing into what they really want. And they're missing the big picture. Like I've had a couple guys come to me who are, you know, in their 30s and they went to the clinic and they got their TRT. But then they come to me and I ask them some questions and it's like they're still getting 3 hours of sleep at night. They're eating twice a day. And when they do eat, it's usually junk food or fast food. They're still drinking alcohol. I'm like, bro, what are you doing? Like it doesn't work that way. You might be taking this supplement or doing this TRT or whatever it might be. But if you're not fixing the big buckets, you're just continuing to, you're filling a bucket that has holes in it. It's never going to work.
Yeah, I find it frustrating just because I know I said earlier that I'm not very sympathetic, but I do feel...
I disagree with that, but...
I do feel for the people that go to these clinics that actually want to make actionable change, and they end up getting burned in the end.
Yeah.
Obviously, what those clinics are really designed for is people that know what they want already, and they just are they're going to pay whatever price it takes to get their testosterone.
Walmart,
yeah.
Yeah.
But the people that actually have issues and want to make real change in their life, they're going to just get burned in the end because they're at the wrong place.
Yeah, exactly. And there are many of them because they're most maybe gaslit by the system where the doctor or whoever said, oh, you're within the range of testosterone, you're fine. Like the range of testosterone, you know, is huge.
It's a wild range.
If I'm talking to a guy who has a testosterone of 260 and a guy who has a testosterone of 800, they're both within range, but they're two very different men.
Right.
Right? And treat the symptoms, not the range.
Right. If diet does matter the most and is this, you know, a fundamental principle that everyone has to get. And, you know, GLP-1s don't work as well. Testosterone doesn't work as well. Obviously, both can help body composition. Then again, why do both of you think that so many dietitians and doctors are obese and also not cardiovascularly fit and or weak or all three of those?
I think that anybody could fall. Like I was talking to Cameron earlier. I see a lot of diverse people, from young 20s super fit guy to your, 55-year-old menopausal female and everything in between. They all still have the same issues. We are, overworked. We have long commutes. We have kids. We have other responsibilities. You're moving up the ladder in your career. Suddenly other things take priority. That happens to the best of us. So if you don't have this framework that you take with you wherever you are, it's easy to get lost. So like for me, I have a long commute. I spend about 2.5 hours in a car every day. I wake up 4 a.m. I get home, do the kids thing. I coach soccer, all those things. But I also have things in place to protect me, which is I eat breakfast. I never skip a meal. High protein diet. I still make sure that I am intentional about moving my body, going for walks when I can. There are days when I might move less than others, but, I always make sure that I work out. I do resistance training. I always will, my whole life. I hope to be the 90-year-old woman who's still lifting in the gym with all the young dudes, and they're looking at me like, wow, she's amazing. That's my goal in life. So you have to have these mechanisms in place. You can't say, I'll wait till, after this kid's birthday party or after this thing or one thing slow down. You're lying to yourself. It's never going to slow down.
Yeah, I agree.
Do you think that doctors are mostly overweight just because of the toxic statins and medications they take?
No.
Or what's the deal with that? Because I know I struggled most with body composition, during early residency, which shouldn't be a surprise, 24-hour shifts, et cetera.
Yeah.
But, there's not really anything. There's partial excuses, but there's no such thing as a true excuse.
I agree. Yeah, I think doctors are mainly, not all doctors, but a majority of doctors are overweight. One, because they probably take their own advice on diets. No, I'm just kidding. I just think a lot of doctors know.
Orange juice with breakfast.
I think a lot of doctors do know what they're talking about, especially with diets. They're very smart people. But
I would disagree.
They're probably just lazy in terms of their own diet and lifestyle. Although they know what to do. It's kind of like one of those things where it's like, do what I say, not what I do.
They know what to do. What do you mean they know what to do?
Well, I think most of them know that if they eat less and move more, they'll lose the weight that they have.
But do they know how to incorporate that or make that into a habit?
Probably.
You might have an idea. If their compensation and pay increased, then maybe they would learn it better.
Mandatory nutrition courses for all med students. But again, a nutrition class is not going to fix that, right? Like, it's just not. Need to work with a multidisciplinary team, which is why I'm so fortunate to have this relationship, because I love the multi-D team that we have here, the like-minded growth mindset, place for everything, diet, lifestyle, medication, supplements, all has a time and place for most people. I don't think physicians are necessarily naive or maybe, they might know it, they may not do it. But there are other factors too. They're in that high stress environment. So we know that what high cortisol can do, which could lead to more abdominal obesity, more insulin resistance. Now you're on shift work, which is also working against you, because now if you're eating overnight, you're working night shift, your cholesterol is going to go up, your blood pressure is going to go up, your blood sugar is going to stay in your system longer, which is going to cause more proliferative inflammation in your body and your brain. Which is going to make you crave more of those fun foods, like I call them, the savory, the sweet foods. And honestly, if you're working night shift, the only thing that's open is like fast food. That's it. Or maybe, you know, if it's been a busy night in the hospital, they didn't get to eat at all. And then they get home, they're starving, or their stress relief is, their stress relief of choice is, you know, whiskey or bourbon or whatever alcohol beverage you want to add. Because that's the one thing that they can do to escape it.
Tequila, because it's keto.
Oh, yes. I heard it's better for your gut.
If they were strict keto, would they be better off?
No. I don't think they'd be better off.
I ate, not keto, but I ate very low carb.
You're close.
When I was doing lots of night shifts and whatnot in the hospital. Just so I didn't have that dip after. And I still managed to gain some weight and some fat. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. People say, oh, yeah, if you're strict keto, then it's impossible to get out of shape.
Yeah.
And to that, I say, hold my beer. Let me get
it. Yeah.
Just kidding. But in all seriousness, what do you think about things like orange juice or fruits?
Mm-hmm.
Because people know I am not a fan of orange juice or, in general, any sugar-sweetened liquid calorie beverage.
Mm-hmm.
And then also let me know you guys' thoughts on bananas, melons.
Oh, man.
Pineapple.
In melons, you include watermelon?
Yes.
Are you serious?
I include watermelon, mostly because I just don't love it. But
no, yeah, just because you don't like it doesn't mean that you should not recommend it.
This is my bias, but particularly things like honeydew melon and cantaloupe.
Yes.
Yeah.
So obviously, again, I'll start with it depends. But overall, adults really don't need caloric beverages. You should not be getting your fruit serving predominantly from orange juice, right? Like it could be a fruit serving, but it's missing the fiber that you get from eating orange. It's also a lot easier to consume more calories if you drink it versus if you eat it. Like a glass of orange juice, I don't know, 120 calories, an orange, 60.
Yeah.
You know, and you feel more full by eating an orange. Like literally the mastication of food, chewing your food will give you more of a satiety feeling than drinking it. So a lot of times I tell people that, like, if they're like, Diane, I really want to go on a detox cleanse, this green juice, whatever it might be, we can get into that. But I'll tell you, you're going to hate your life at first because you're missing that chewing factor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then it's going to rebound and you're going to really hate your life. Mm-hmm. But I think that as a dietitian, I don't villainize any fruit. I think all fruit can fit.
Good thing I can.
However, I do harp on deeply colored fruits and vegetables. So berries, cherries, raspberries, blueberries, all the things. Because we know that there's really specific literature on like blueberries and cognitive function. Really good antioxidants. So I am purposeful and intentional with recommending those. But I do that without saying don't do those other fruits, but I really put a higher emphasis on the berries and the deeply colored things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I don't think when someone's eating a whole pineapple or whatever it is, they're like, oh, I'm eating healthy. I'm like,
first of all, who does that?
I know. Well, I'm over-exaggerating. When someone's eating pineapple and rather than maybe some sort of candy, and they end up eating more pineapple than they would of the candy, they're eating more calories.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of fruit out there that is really not, like Kyle says, fruit really. It's more like candy.
But a banana is not a fruit. A plantain is a fruit.
It's a GMO, actually.
But if they want to switch out like a banana for their nightly ice cream, I think that makes a ton of sense. But I do, like you say, anytime someone asks me about fruits, which is quite often, if you imagine, even though I'm not a dietitian, I always, berries are your go-to. It's strawberries, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries. I think for calorie-wise and just like low glycemic index, if you want to look at that with any, you know, grain of salt, those are the ones that you'd want to consume. And you can eat a lot of them too and not eat very many calories. Also, I do like watermelon. I love watermelon.
Watermelon's
low
great.
Calorie.
Yeah.
It's low calorie. I can eat the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he doesn't like it.
But also, keep in mind, it depends on who you're talking to, right? If I'm talking to somebody who just finished ranger school or a D1 athlete or pro athlete, there's space for like tart cherry juice, 100% pomegranate juice, yeah, blueberry juice, like absolutely, whether you drink it straight up to help with your recovery, to help with sleep, or maybe you use it as a base for a smoothie. Those individuals who have a higher caloric expenditure and more muscle damage need more options when it comes to fruit or any food.
For sure. The majority of people I talk to, meaning 99% of them, is overweight family members and friends, and then the occasional random person I meet on the street.
Yeah.
Before you add in things like pomegranate juice or tart cherry juice, what body fat percent on a DEXA should you be at as a male or a female before considering adding those things on?
I don't think I can even say that, because athletes come in all shapes and sizes. And just because you're not considered super lean, which for males is, you know, the minimum body fat for males is roughly about 5%. Minimum body fat for females is roughly 12%.
It's like starving, dying body fat.
Yeah, basically. You're just, hey, you're miserable, okay? You're thinking about food all the time. Unless you're just a genetic freak, which are those. Even if I'm talking to like a thrower or an NFL football player, they are not 12% body fat. They're not, unless you're a skilled position, which is another story. But both the skilled position and the lineman can both benefit from tart cherry juice, blueberry juice, whatever it might be, but both very different bodies. So I don't have like a threshold for body fat percent when I do or don't recommend a juice. It depends on what they do.
Do you have a threshold? And you could answer with the caveat that this is purely for health. So they don't need to maintain a certain weight to be like a lineman or sumo wrestler.
Yeah, if I'm not thinking about like lineman or like sumo strongman wrestlers.
Competitor. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like obviously yeah, if those are different. If you're competing in World's Strongest Man, then that's probably the most extreme example. You have to weigh 400 plus pounds and you're basically force feeding 24/7. So
large human.
But yeah, I guess from your perspective, let's say someone's at the gym and they're like trying to be healthy but look lean and aesthetic.
What body fat percentage should they shoot for?
Before adding in your like pomegranate juices, tart cherry juices, sugar into your smoothie.
Between 9% and 10%, I would say. I think that's pretty reasonable.
Yeah.
So females like 20%. Female 20%,
yeah. Well, you're still a little fluffy.
Yeah.
But you know, if you've gotten down to that point, and it's not just like you're already at that point, then you know what you're doing diet-wise in terms of knowing how to lower your calories and what calories mean.
Yeah. I think that's also reasonable if you're really trying to emphasize fat loss and aesthetics.
Yeah. I think they look better.
NFL players care more about like their career, being better at their position, and probably the money too.
Yeah.
Than, looking like slightly more shredded in the abdomen.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a good discussion. I think that's probably a good place to kind of transition into the second part of the podcast. But I thought it might be fun to ask both of you, you know, what are some things that are demonized in some circles and not in others, and including things that I do. For example, I think sweet potatoes are overrated compared to regular potatoes.
Oh, they're so good, though.
So, well, I do not think that they're okay. They're very good. So I think they're overrated. I prefer to get my, xanthophylls and orange pigment.
Yeah.
Pigment just from marigold extracts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, you know, lutein, zeaxanthine.
Yeah. Just eating orange pepper.
Yeah.
Orange sweet pepper. Yeah.
That too. But anyway, the first item is, what do you think? Overrated, underrated? Just what do you think about it in general? Sweet potato.
I think it's probably overrated. I think people associate it with weight loss.
Yeah.
Especially like maybe around 2010, 2014 is when it got really popular. I think they shouldn't associate it necessarily with weight loss, but if they want to associate it with like a healthier alternative to the regular potato and then still realize that it's around the same calories as a regular potato, then I think that's good. But I do think it's very overrated for what it
is. I would agree. I think a lot of people who come in, give me their diet recall, and they're really trying. They're like, it's always sweet potato. It's never a white potato. And I think it's just been kind of ingrained in our society. Like, sweet potatoes are better. And, they offer some different nutrients. But like you said, for the same portion, it's about the same calories. Yeah. And white potatoes, just because it looks not nutritious, because normally Americans consume white potatoes in the form of French fries. But white potatoes can be super nutritious. Very good for you. when cooked appropriately.
Yeah.
So I don't have a preference either way. It's get a potato in there. Just cook it well. Season it well. Throw some herbs and spices on there and add something different.
Mm-hmm. Bad advice. Potatoes have oxalates.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, you guys just gave hundreds of people bad advice. do we need to be worried about oxalates?
It's never part of my conversation, honestly. That would be
unless
such
they
a
have, like, oxalate
yeah,
kidney stones.
That would be such an individual issue. It's just not broad enough for me to bring that up in regular conversations. You know, just make sure you're hydrated well enough, make sure you're consuming enough calcium sources, and call it a day. If you have further issues than that, then we can dive in individually.
Yeah. I think it's way overrated. Completely overrated.
I think there's actually merit to consuming, you know, reasonably low to moderate amounts of oxalates because that helps support Oxalobacter genus, like Oxalobacter formigenes, that helps digest oxalates in the gut. So, I kind of see that as a benefit. Now, I know a lot of people avoid oxalates for other reasons, but Greg Doucette likes to do what's called a straw man argument for dietitians. And he says his clients will go to a dietitian because they have a fat loss goal.
Sure.
Because that's the only conceivable goal that someone could have. Right?
That's the only reason why people would see a dietitian, right? They just want to lose fat. There's no other reason to see a dietitian.
Yeah, it's funny. And obviously it's great to see a dietitian for fat loss goals. But anyway, his clients go to a dietitian and they say, well, the problem why you're not losing fat is you're not eating enough fat. You need to eat more avocados. So what about those avocados?
I love avocados. I do think that a lot of people who come in to see me or anybody who have gotten some kind of meal plan from some trainer, whoever outside of here, a lot of the meal plans have the same theme. They're all high protein, which I have no problem with. Every meal plan I design is always high protein. But there's a really high protein, and it's low carb and then even lower fat. I'm like, man, like, you're 6'2" and you're consuming 45 grams of fat. Like, that's low, by the way, you guys.
Especially if you're not on TRT.
That's low. Take your, like, testosterone. Yeah, and if so, you could potentially be under eating, first of all, but also you need fat, you need carbs for the training that you're doing to support muscle protein synthesis, to support your immune health, to support your bioavailability of your fat-soluble vitamins. To support your testosterone. If you're deficient in vitamin D, that in itself could lower your testosterone. Mm-hmm. So in a way, like, if somebody were to come in and tell me something like that, like, of course I would tell them, you need more fat. We know that low-fat diets are not better than a normal caloric deficit diet. We know that. There's evidence to show that. Low-fat diets is such, like, a 90s trend. These diets come and go, like, every decade. It's not low fat. It's the right kind of fat that we need to have the messaging for. And avocados have that right kind of fat, the monounsaturated fatty acids. They may be more expensive in some places than others, but it is one of the many options for good, healthy fats for people to include in their diet.
All right. Noted. I will consume 6 avocados before bed every night so I get shredded. What do you think about avocados?
In terms of, like, going to a dietitian and then being like, oh, you need to eat more. I feel like they're thinking calories. So fat being the highest, you know, in calorie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you have eating metabolic damage.
Right. The only time I think that's reasonable to do is, for example, I have this family member. She doesn't do anything legitimately. And she eats very infrequently and very little. But what she does eat when she does is just very crap.
Yeah.
Lots of sugar or just, like, fried food. Yeah. So I think if she was wanting to lose weight, because she is overweight, not substantially, but she is overweight.
Yeah.
If she wanted to lose weight, what I would actually recommend her doing is eating more.
Yeah. And that's
exercising as well, or at least walking.
Yeah. That's a really, really hard thing for when patients come in to see me and they're underfed, and at least by what their diet recall tells me. And I know that based on this person's basal metabolic rate, how it's the estimated rate there, and what they're telling me don't match up. It's a hard conversation. It's a slow, you have to make sure that you have buy-in and trust from the patient first, because if somebody doesn't trust me telling them they need to consume 300 more calories a day, they're gonna be like, no, Heck no. Next person, I'm going to go see somebody who's going to tell me what I want to hear. Mm-hmm. And you have to give it to them straight. Say, if you're underfed, you may initially gain a little bit of weight, but it's going to come off. It's going to take some time. So you got to stick with me. And that's why I always say, you really need to see if you're really wanting to dial into your health nutrition, you need more than one appointment with a dietitian. One appointment is not enough.
What about fats like seed oils? Should those be avoided at all costs?
Gosh, I'm so tired of this conversation.
Is it just a yes or a no?
I think it's pretty simple. I think it's a definitely no. It shouldn't be avoided. I think everyone's looking for a boogeyman to point fingers mm-hmm. at
yeah.
on why they're having this issue rather mm-hmm. than being like, oh, well, maybe I'm just eating 9,000 calories a day mm-hmm. or I need to exercise more. Actually, yeah. I don't think that seed oils are the biggest issue. I think if you're already in a good, I don't know, body fat percentage or just healthy lifestyle in general. Yeah. And if you want to get even better, yeah, maybe mm-hmm. stop eating so much seed oil. But I don't think it's the big demon there.
I mean, you're right. Like everybody wants to look at, they want to make nutrition black and white. It will never be black and white. It's never that easy. Health is never that easy. There's always multiple factors here. And it's not just, there's multiple peer-reviewed studies on seed oils and decreasing cardiovascular risk and improving health outcomes and decreasing mortality, morbidity, whatever it might be. It's there. And you don't see that when you look at beef tallow or saturated fat, quite the opposite with those. So the literature speaks for itself. But again, like because nutrition research is so hard to do and it's so contradictory, if you have in your mind that seed oils are bad, you can find literature that tells you seed oils are bad. Yeah. It's confirmation bias. Like, oh, see, I told you. But then you have to look into the study design and all those things and what other factors were there.
Well, if they did that, then they'd be proven
wrong. I know, but that's, mm-hmm. yeah. But also, like, thinking about if you're consuming a lot of these oils, what's your overall diet look like? Maybe that's the bigger problem.
Oh,
maybe
it's 100% ultra-processed foods
yeah.
that
yeah.
have the seed oils on them.
Yeah, and it's like we're focusing on the wrong thing. It's like the target is here, but you're over in no man's land.
Yeah, it's not the 2,000 calorie burger you had, Kyle. It's the seed oils that were in it.
We need to remember, like the quote goes, you know, don't lose the forest through the trees, because it's true. Like you focus on that mm-hmm. and you miss the whole idea of the forest. Mm-hmm.
Shout out to our podcast episodes. Maybe we can post them above that discuss the rare genotype where your CRP goes up after you consume oils like canola mm-hmm. oil. Mm-hmm. And also our kind of breakdown of seed oils and the cyclooxygenase systems and arachidonic acid systems.
Yeah.
And I know we're both fans of the omega quant intracellular omega check. Mm-hmm. So still get your levels checked. This is a similar discussion, but rather than ask you guys if you're pro-carb or anti-carb, since you're trying to team up on me here, because I'm trying to get some gotchas, but... Yeah. How do people know if they should be higher carb, mm-hmm. medium carb, or lower carb?
So I tell people, technically there are four buckets, but there are three buckets in which you can get your calories from, right? Carbs, proteins, fats, and alcohol.
Ketones.
And
ketones. Is alcohol, right?
But obviously, as a dietitian, you know, we don't really build in macros for alcohol in your meal plan, right? That is incidental. We can talk about that later. But when I build meal plans, I always start with protein. So figure out what the protein is first, because that really doesn't change based on the person's activity level. It might go down a little bit if their carbs are really high, if they're an endurance athlete. But I start there. And then I go to calculate their carbs. And carbs are really based on how active you are. So if you're desk duty, if you're maybe working night shift, if you're low activity, like less than 9 hours a week, you could go from like, I go as low as 2 to 3 grams per kg carbs.
Nice.
Because you're just not, you don't need any more fuel than that, right? Like I'm driving, you know, 10 minutes down the street versus I'm driving to California, right? You don't need as much fuel in the tank to get to where you need to go.
What if you don't care about performance at all?
You don't care about performance, but you got to care about health, right?
to some degree.
I mean, it still doesn't change, right? Like if you don't care about performance, it depends on what kind of performance, right? Is it a high intensity training session that you're doing? Because high intensity training sessions demand carbs. That is your primary fuel source. There's no trumping physiology there.
But the CrossFit methodology thing says low carb on it.
Oh, CrossFit.
Why don't they change that? CrossFitters are all, like, almost all of them are very cool, other than being annoying sometimes. But why don't they change something like that? No sugar, little carb is what it says.
You know,
a lot of things about CrossFit is wrong.
Gotta be ripped.
Yeah.
Gotta be ripped.
I don't think the amount of carbs you have matters. Unless you're training, like unless you're actually training for a competition, you need to work, like you need to be at your peak performance. I don't think unless you're that person, if you're not, I don't think it really matters.
Yeah.
I think if you hit your protein goal, really just fill up the rest of calories with whatever you want.
But think about too, like where do we get fiber from? You're not getting it from protein and you're certainly not getting it from fat. So if fiber is essential.
Oh,
for everything.
Carnivore dieters
say otherwise. It's
so essential for everything, for gut function, for gut brain connection, for short chain fatty acids, for energy production, for nutrient synthesis, you name it. And if you cut out carbs, aside from performance, you're diminishing your health. You're putting yourself at a significant risk for a number of things. Mm. You have to have carbs for fiber.
What if you're enhanced? I think Seth Ferrosi is a famous keto dieter, massive bodybuilder. But yeah, I mean, what if you just don't care about mental function whatsoever? 100% of your life goal, and also, in his case at least, your income is just based off of having huge slabs of muscle and then, you know, being a keto bro.
I mean, I guess if that's what his main thing is, kind of back to the argument with like a football player. I guess if that's what they prioritize over their health, it doesn't matter.
But also don't believe everything you see. Just because you see somebody advertising something doesn't mean they're actually doing it.
That's true. He's a, what do they call it? A reverse fake natty or something
that. Nothing surprises me anymore.
I
think that the keto diet has its time and place, and there are better ways to do it. Keto diet is not the butter bacon diet. Like, that is the wrong way to do it. There's definitely individuals who could benefit from it, whether it's for mental health or TBI recovery or just a need to get weight off immediately. There are times and places for that, but it still needs to be well-controlled and potentially temporary. Because it's not just carbs and fiber that they're missing. They're also potentially risking bone health. And they're missing all the nutrients that come from food sources that contain carbs. So those antioxidants that protect your immune system and your brain health, your vitamin D, calcium, your B vitamins, your vitamin E, everything. Anytime you remove a food group or are in a caloric deficit in some way, you run the risk of potential micronutrient deficiencies. If you're deficient of a macronutrient, you're likely going to be deficient of a micronutrient. And you can't look at somebody and see that.
Well, you also can't see micronutrients. They're so small. How do you actually know they're real?
Oh, man.
I mean, most conspiracy theories do turn out to be true.
Right? So if you can't see it, it must not be real.
How do we really know there's micronutrients?
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
Good thing we got labs for that.
Yeah.
But also symptoms.
They made the labs up.
Symptomology. Oh, man. Well, then we're all screwed.
Yeah.
Someone commented after I posted something that said, food is medicine.
Yeah.
And they posted, name one thing that has shown that food is medicine.
Oh, my gosh.
And I think there's studies from more than 100 years ago, if I remember right.
Yeah.
On macrocytic anemias being corrected by certain foods. Yeah. I think that's how we learned about vitamin B12, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
So maybe those things are real and we need to keep checking them. Why doesn't the doctor check those labs?
Why doesn't the doctor
check
your
vitamins
check a lot
and
of
nutrients? Yeah. If they're real, then, you know, your GP would check them. If they're real, then insurance would cover those getting checked.
They also don't check SHBG and free testosterone quite frequently.
Yeah, that's true. You mentioned that people lose a lot when they remove a food group. Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned that blueberries might be healthy. Mm-hmm. However, you probably didn't know this, they do have fructose in them.
Oh, no.
So unfortunately, people will have to remove this from the diet. But there is good scientific evidence that fructose makes rats fat. And perhaps if you're dirty bulking, you get more visceral adipose, like in and around the liver. Mm-hmm. But why hasn't this panned out in humans? Yeah. Because the preclinical science looks pretty good.
Yeah. So again, humans are not rats and vice versa. But also, there's a lot of other benefits that come from whole fruit other than just the carbohydrate that makes it. You're getting those antioxidants, you're getting the phytochemicals, things you can't just put in a pill because it won't be bioavailable. And nobody's obese from eating too many blueberries. I have yet to see that. I dare you. I honestly dare you. I would, my brain instantly goes to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Blueberry guy, yes.
Yeah. No. What form of fructose are you getting? Are you getting it from a whole fruit or are you getting it from high fructose corn syrup? And now we're getting into processed food. And now we're getting back into the debate of, is it the high fructose corn syrup or is it the fact that you're eating a high processed food diet?
Yeah, well, I think with the high fructose corn syrup, it's so easy to consume.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to, there's like very little fructose in one blueberry.
Yeah.
But when you put high fructose corn syrup in like Chex Mix.
Yeah.
You know, when you make that Christmas thing, there's a lot of that in there.
Yeah. But remember, like food scientists switched to high fructose corn syrup because it's cheaper and it's sweeter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it was a natural marketing ploy for them for making tastier products perhaps and saving a buck on their end. But again, it just goes back to, you know, how much of that makes up your diet. If that makes up more, if processed food makes up more than 10% of your diet and you're not an active person, you're probably in trouble.
Is it the same thing for alcohol? It can make up to 10% of the calories in your diet and you're good to go?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, I do account for alcohol in my diet. I write my own plan and have alcohol.
Well, you know, I do have real life because I live in the real world, right? So I have real conversations with patients who are like, Diana, like, I really want to be as consistent as I can. I want to follow your plan, but I also want to enjoy my Friday night, whatever it might be. How can I legitimately do this? And I do talk them through like ways that you could just be smarter about it. So first of all, like not drinking on an empty stomach. Don't go to a restaurant starving because you're going to just – the intent behind any nutrition thought is going to be way gone. Don't drink to get drunk. And if you're getting drunk – if you're trying to get drunk to de-stress whatnot, you probably need to talk to somebody who's not me.
Yep.
Like a counselor or somebody who's trained who can help sort that out. So making sure that I plug that in there. But, hey, I might say – maybe instead of having, you know, an extra serving of avocado on your salad at lunch, let's, you know, you can save some of that fat calories for the alcohol and whatnot on those days. Yeah. So flexing a little bit, but staying in the real world because people are going to do what people are going to do. And me as a dietitian or us as a practitioner, it's our job to bump and steer them into the best possible case where they would succeed.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. Yeah, that's kind of what I do. Now, I don't adhere to it as well as what you just laid out. So, like, not drinking on an empty stomach, it's the best time to drink.
Because you only need one.
Hit it
you
fast.
Only need one, really. But if I'm going to drink on a Friday or something like that, it's usually, like, one or two whiskeys.
Yeah.
And that's between, if it's just whiskey, it's probably around 400 calories.
Yeah.
For both of them.
Yeah.
So I'll just eliminate 400 calories from something I was going to eat earlier.
Yeah.
And then use it up with that.
Yep.
Sometimes... don't you have like a bubbly water or a sparkling water like LaCroix and then just an L-theanine and you can kind of placebo yourself into, it's like a,
you can,
you know, mocktails often have a bunch of sugar and junk in them.
That's really bad.
But I think that and some people do the Zevia drinks. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of options of fun drinks. I suppose the We're not sponsored by them in any way, but the hard ketones might be another option. Although the downside of this is a whole bunch of calories, about 100 per can.
That's about a beer. Yeah. So that's a light beer.
It's quite a few calories, but I guess if you're bulking.
Tastes about as bad as alcohol too.
Yeah, which some people might like. it is not good.
I kind of like
that. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of like it's the same thing as a pig or a Cybertruck. It's so ugly that it's almost kind of cute.
Yeah.
Like, it's revolting. Makes you want one. It makes you want one.
I'm going to mute that Cybertruck. You're going to tear down my stock even more.
but I mean, I think to some degree, that's the human experience regarding alcohol and even maybe spicy food to some degree, because you get a little bit of that endorphin response. Mm-hmm. But I guess, why do humans learn to like disgustingly tasting foods and drinks?
Man.
That's interesting. I like pain, obviously not in a weird way, but I like, you know, like when you're working out, I like the feel of like this is hurting.
50% masochism.
Yeah. Well, not that much, but I think that's similar to like taste as well. Like, man, that tastes bad. Let me get another drink of that.
But I also think it's
like that, or like it burns, you know.
Mm-hmm. Alcohol is just the most accepted throughout society form of drug.
Not after Huberman's podcast.
I mean, he did. That's we were talking about that earlier. Yeah, I will say that was a very good episode.
He did some good work on that.
Yeah, that was very good. And it's important, because if practitioners just dismiss those comments immediately or say, just don't drink because it's bad for you. But why? People need to know the why. And one of the great things that's come out of all these podcasts and functional stuff, whatever it might be, is people are having more conversations about this. They are more curious about what food and drinks are doing to their health and what they could possibly control. And they're pushing back against the systems against us. But I think overall, a lot of the reason why people consume alcohol or things that don't taste good is just because society has welcomed it. And because we're all chronically stressed. And for that moment, when you're consuming that beverage, if you don't have other parameters to release stress, like I was kind of mentioning earlier, whether it's exercise or eating well or getting outside, whatever it might be, then that's your go-to. And that's accepted by everybody.
Would you rather lose 5 health dollars now or gain 2 health dollars in a year?
That's really hard. It's that delayed gratification. It's hard to... Like we were saying earlier, like, oh, well, I don't want to pay for a gym membership because $100 a month is too much. Well, imagine what your hospital bill is going to be when you have a heart attack or when you have obesity or whatever it might be.
We'll link the Canadian video to the last 10 years of life of someone who exercises versus someone who doesn't. That's pretty crazy.
Yeah.
But maybe it would be more interesting. There's the movie where your time left alive is on your wrist.
Oh, yeah,
I've seen that.
What is that
what
movie?
If it was like they should have people drink alcohol and then just time off just gets eliminated off their wrist.
I don't know if I'd like that.
Yeah, and then if you don't, it slowly adds up.
Yeah.
That'd be interesting.
That would be really
interesting. It probably definitely change the amount of alcohol purchased per year.
So I guess we've successfully dodged the how much alcohol you can drink in a month question, or should we still answer how many standard drinks per month? Because people ask per week.
Yeah.
But I think it's much better to think about it in a month-to-month basis.
That is definitely one of the questions that's on the assessments that I give patients is how many drinks do you have per week? How many drinks do you have per session? Okay, so just because you drank once this month doesn't mean that 12 beers is okay. obviously, if it's at that frequency, that's not that bad. But I still go once a week, ideally. So I would agree with Huberman on that. But certainly, if it's during the week and that's your stress relief, that's where I raise more of a red flag.
Mm-hmm. Some of the rules I use for myself, and I think you kind of have these same ones, is you're not using it to cover up something or medicate something.
Yeah.
If it's for a social reason, I think there can be social benefit to that because... Yeah. Unfortunately, it's kind of part of the human experience at this point. If you have 3 young kids like me, and a wife that is either pregnant or breastfeeding off and on, mm-hmm. that might mean three or four times. And, you know, you might three or four times per year.
Yeah.
Not per month.
Yeah.
Per year. But sometimes that's for the better, because if you're just doing it to do it, then it's not as, you don't get the social benefit.
Yeah.
If someone's drinking once a week, I think it depends on what the liquor is. Mm-hmm. If it's like a whiskey or a mixed drink, I'd say probably two per week. So, because that night they're going to have two drinks.
Yeah.
They're not going to just have one.
Yeah.
Realistically.
Yeah.
And if it's beer, probably four per week.
Yeah.
Because they're going to have four that night.
Yep.
If they have one, there's no way someone just drinks one beer. And if they do, that's awesome. But usually that's not the case. So it's probably around 12 to like eight drinks.
And then keep in mind that, you know, regardless of what your diet is, that shouldn't change. You should still not overconsume alcohol, no matter how good your diet is. But if you have a good routine, if you exercise regularly, if you have a good diet, you have a little bit more room for stuff like that. And not, again, not saying that you're allowed a bigger allowance of alcohol. It just means that you can get by without any significant health changes.
If you're on a massive diet, it's kind of like a cheat day or a reward for a successful week, you know, whether that be like cake for you or it's four beers for you. You know,
I hate the cheat day idea.
Oh, cheat meals are usually what I mean.
Yeah.
Not a day.
I actually challenge people instead of like, because Friday, Saturday, for some reason, just it's like this enigma, like, oh, that's my day where I get to just do whatever. I'd honestly rather you break up the monotony of the week and have your quote unquote cheat meal on Wednesday night. And that way, Friday, Saturday doesn't have to be this like massive overhaul in your diet where you just fall completely off the rail. Because sometimes people are less active on the weekend.
Yeah.
I want you to have that meal when you're more active.
Definitely.
Yeah. That would be ideal.
What does a meal like that look like? Is that when you incorporate nuts or, you know, people are always
cheat
like,
meal?
You know, people say, oh yeah, nuts are super high calorie. You should never consume peanuts or cashews because they are mostly fat. Yeah. They're not a great protein source.
No, they're not.
When do you incorporate those? Or do you just say, cut them out completely? Probably not.
No, I think that nuts and seeds are excellent source of nutrition. It boils down to portion. Now, I had one patient a while ago who ate twice a day. And then at night, he just said, oh, I just have a couple cashews.
Yeah,
How much is a couple cashews? It ended up being like three handfuls of cashews. I'm like, bro, that's like two meals.
Mm-hmm.
And so we definitely changed that. But again, you should not demonize peanut butter. Anybody who's on a weight loss, weight gain train could consume peanut butter equally. Maybe not equally. I walk back on that. But be mindful that it just boils down to portion. And if you are consuming like a 1 to 2 ounce portion of nuts, that's perfectly appropriate for any snack or whatever it may be. But if that portion starts to go up, that might be more appropriate for somebody who's trying to gain weight because it's higher calorie in a smaller portion.
Yeah, I completely agree. My mother does that. She's in pretty good shape.
Mm-hmm.
She's got a little fluff that she wants to lose. And she's always riding around in her car and she's got a big container of mixed nuts.
I always tell people,
what are you doing?
Pre-portionate nuts. Because never eat. If I'm sitting at my desk and I have a Costco sized bag of trail mix or whatnot on my desk, just psychologically, I'm going to eat more of it.
Mm-hmm. Right? Oh, yeah.
Because it's there, first of all. I might not even be hungry, but it's there. So I'm going to eat it. And that goes for any office snack that you see. But take some time at night or on the weekend, whatever your day is where you have a little bit of time in the kitchen, pre-portion it into little snack bags, and then that way you can just grab it and go.
I do that.
James and I love anything that is brought to the office, whether it's nuts or cookies or whatever else. We always try to put out our canned chicken or canned salmon just so people have choices. And yes, I did eat my canned chicken this morning, and I did eat my canned salmon yesterday morning.
Oh, look at that. Those omega threes.
13 and 15 ounces.
They'll even stick them in the cooking container. They'll put the tuna in there with it.
That sounds like an April Fool's thing. Did you do that on April Fool's?
No.
We do it all the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's interesting because none of the tuna or chicken ever gets taken.
That's
weird. Always just the cookies.
unless it's me.
Unless it's you, of course.
Probably need some hot sauce.
True, yeah. That might be the case.
Is it the same concept with butter compared to nut butter? So whether it's cashew butter, macadamia nut butter, peanut butter, all of which I like.
Yeah.
can you just use, you know, like a grass-fed butter the same way? Could, you know, my kids like butter a lot, but
it's so much.
It's even lower protein than nuts, but actually not that much different from like a macro calorie standpoint. Yeah. So
probably a lot less palatable. Maybe.
Depends on the person.
Yeah, not for my kids.
I don't generally recommend people walk around with a stick of butter and just take a chomp out of that. You do get a lot of other nutrients from nut and seed butters too, like magnesium and vitamin E and whatnot. Sure. Those are also easy sources of those nutrients that are often deficient in our diets. Yep. Especially love recommending flaxseed, chia seeds, pumpkin seeds, because it's so easy and cheaper than nuts. Mm. But yeah, again, like any fat source, which would be like the butters, the nuts, the nut butters, the avocados are higher calorie per gram. So you do need to make sure that your portions are more appropriate. And if you are minding your macros, it's really easy to go high in fat, which people note when they start logging their meals. They're like, wow, I'm overshooting my fat. Why is that? And then that allows me as a dietitian to dive into that, say, hey, most of the meats you're consuming are higher fat. Let's dial the fat back on those so that you can have more room for those healthy fats, which is what I want. So it's not about low fat, it's about choosing the right fat.
For every 5% body fat percentage points you're over what's considered healthy, how many supplements or medications do you think you need to take to balance that out? Try to answer it with mostly just a number.
Oof.
5%. So for females, let's say they're around 40% body fat on a DEXA instead of 33 or 35. Yeah. And for males, let's say they're about 30% rather than about 23 to 25.
So how many meds or supplements should they be taking?
Do they need just to offset the various downsides of that? So they're not morbidly obese, but they're just a little obese.
I have a tiered approach with my supplements. There's kind of like my baseline where it's most people could benefit from these supplements, which might include a vitamin D, an omega-3, maybe a multivitamin, depending on what their diet lifestyle looks like. Creatine, love creatine. And then you kind of go up from there. Like most people could benefit from those things. Women, men, whatever. And then you kind of go up and individualize a little bit more. Okay, hey, this person isn't getting enough protein. Let me add a whey protein. Or they're really stressed out. Let me potentially add in L-theanine. Or maybe just we'll do matcha tea instead. Whatever it might be. But I think when you are overweight or over fat, which is what I prefer to say, you do run the risk of having poor quality diet, but also maybe not absorbing those nutrients appropriately as a result, or just in general. Maybe there are medications which could also have drug nutrient interactions. So for that person, I would definitely recommend, you know, it's hard to give a number for many reasons. I know you want me to. But at least like my baseline package would apply to them as well. I would probably start there. Like, don't overwhelm that person with a laundry list of things when they're already struggling just to eat basic food.
I agree. I think, I know you want a number. I would say if this person is very, like you said, they're overweight and their diet consists of mainly just really garbage stuff. You'd probably need to replace most of their micronutrients and things that they're not getting. I mean, are they going outside, you know? As you say,
it depends. Vitamin D. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. I thought you were going to say just the usual stuff.
D-ball. Anavar.
GLP-1.
GLP-1.
Is the usual stuff.
I hate saying that. I don't want to say GLP-1. Yeah. It's just getting one out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. On that topic, I've heard a lot of influencers say, well, we're not over fat, we're under muscled.
Yeah.
But if you do a DEXA scan on people who are, you know, morbidly obese, 300 plus pounds, regardless of gender, often they have a pretty good amount of what's detected as lean body mass. Yeah. Yes, a lot of that can be water.
Mm-hmm.
And adipose has 10% lean body mass too.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them have at least high absolute numbers of lean body mass that they then lose as they go through the fat loss phase.
Yeah.
So when people come into you and your practice, and when people come to you at the gym, when they have the concern they don't want to be skinny fat.
Yeah.
And everyone should be concerned about this. And if anything, yeah. females should be more concerned, but it's usually the guys that say I'm skinny fat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Should I bulk and try to gain muscle first?
Yeah.
Or should I go in a fat loss phase? And often the only thing that is stopping these people from starting a GLP-1 is they're afraid of losing
muscle,
yeah. even yeah. though at a low dose, they're not going to yeah. lose anymore.
Yeah.
What do you tell people? Bulk, recomp, yeah. lose fat. What do they do first?
I hate that. I hate bulking. I hate recomping. I think it's really dumb.
I feel offended.
I said that intentionally. You can absolutely gain muscle and lose fat at the same time. You don't have to pick one, okay? I need you to get into the gym and actually lift weights, like really lift weights. I don't care if you're male, female, what age you are. It should be something that's mandatory throughout life for everybody. It helps tremendously. There's no supplement, there's no diet plan that I could give you that's going to give you a better result than that. The diet just supports that exercise. Okay, I could give you 300 grams protein and you're not going to build muscle on 300 grams protein, but it'll help to support that muscle protein synthesis that you're getting from the resistance training process.
I like that.
Yeah, I think it depends if the person is actually skinny fat. I've heard a lot of people say they're skinny fat. I'm like, no, you're just actually fat.
Hmm.
But if they are actually skinny fat, I think they could, they definitely should not go on like a quote unquote cut. Mm-hmm. They'll just end up in a worse position, I think, because mm-hmm. there's a reason why they're mm-hmm. skinny fat. I think they should either bulk with intention, meaning they're actually taking the gym seriously and they're eating correctly. They're mm-hmm. eating enough calories and they're eating good calories. Or they should, like you said, main gain,
yeah.
Which is where you can both lose fat
yeah.
and gain muscle. Yeah.
And that's when consistency really comes in play. Even if yeah. you're on a really crappy training program, you can change your body composition.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, hopefully not getting hurt in the process.
Yeah, with consistency is definitely key. So I like that we've emphasized that. I think that one thing that a lot of people don't realize is what they're worried about, which oftentimes is aesthetic outcome mm-hmm. or their own, because everyone has body dysmorphia, right?
Yeah.
100% of people. When guys lose fat, even if they think they're too skinny,
mm-hmm.
they will look more muscular when they're leaner. Even if their body weight is, because I see this so often. I just don't want to drop below 200 pounds because I'm afraid of being small.
Yeah.
But really, they might look jacked and very muscular at 175.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And conversely, on the female side, very often I see people that are just way too afraid to lift weights. And we've talked about this almost ad nauseum at this point.
Yeah.
But as long as they're not injecting huge amounts of anabolic steroids, they will not look too bulky.
Yeah.
So I think it's important to remember those things, that what they're worried about, which is the aesthetic outcome, is probably not a big deal.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting. Women that want to gain weight look more muscular, heavy. They look more muscular when they're heavy, and it's the other way around when it's with men.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. Yeah. A lot of times I say, the training programs that females think they should do, mm-hmm. which is like, Pilates. Do more cardio, more mobility. The guys should start doing the cardio and the mobility work.
Yeah.
And then
that's true.
The women should add in some resistance training and it'll all balance out. Of course, there's always exceptions.
Yeah.
But you mentioned protein goal of 300 grams per day. Does that mean everyone needs 300 grams per day? And what do they need from your perspective?
I usually start around 2 grams per kg per day. Maybe go to 1 gram per pound if you want to make it easy math. That's high enough. Now, I'll go higher if somebody is injured or immobilized for a period of time, whatever it might be. I've never hit 3 grams per kg and I also don't go below 1.5 grams per kg. So somewhere in that threshold is right for that person. But again, like I said, you have 3 buckets where you could pull calories from. Carbs, proteins, fats. And if I'm working with somebody who's an endurance athlete and their carb count needs to go much higher, I have to pull calories out of somewhere else. And it's usually going to come from protein. So endurance athletes might go as low as 1.2 grams per kg. just to allow more calories for the actual training that they're doing, which goes into carbs. So it's still appropriate protein for that person. But again, like the biggest, the one macro that changes the most is the carbs. But because you only have those three buckets, you got to either pull or add to something else.
Yeah. I think people they overestimate how much protein they think they're eating.
Mm-hmm.
And when they end up tracking it, which usually what I tell people to do is just track your calories for a week. And then from that, I can tell you what you're doing wrong probably.
Mm-hmm. If they're accurate.
If they're accurate, yeah. Their protein's always, almost always under what they thought they were consuming.
Mm-hmm.
So usually what I tell people is just try to consume your body weight and protein every day. And if you're doing that and it gets easier, maybe just add 20 grams.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll probably be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm obviously not a dietitian. I'm just going off of what seems to make the most sense to me.
Yeah. And a lot of times people do have success when they have not been super accurately tracking their protein just by trying to consume as much protein as they reasonably can. Yeah. So
I tell people, like, aim for about 30 grams per meal. 30 to 50 grams for most people works because it's not a crazy large portion, which is may not be appropriate for their digestion, may take the place of other macros on their plate. 30 to 50 grams will be enough to stimulate muscle protein synthesis, will be enough to keep them satiated, satisfied from meal to meal, and still allow them to support their training.
Yep.
I think that's a great one to end on, actually.
Yeah.
I suppose I haven't been a very good moderator because there's a lot of agreement in this debate. But I do hope that this has been a fun way for everyone else to learn good concepts about diet and nutrition and kind of where the actual disconnect is between, you know, the gym bros and the dietitians rather than the straw man arguments and whatnot that they see online.
Yeah.
But we'll post links to all of our social medias and whatnot below. And please let us know questions for this new Jim Bro Versus series and also for Diana, our sports dietitian.
Awesome.
As always, thank you for your time and may God bless you with health and happiness.